Side 8, Robot Dreams, by Isaac Asimov. Continuing with The Last Question, on page 243. The Universal AC said, "A new world, as in such cases, was constructed for their physical bodies in time." "Yes, of course," said Z-Prime, but a sense of loss overwhelmed him even so. His mind released its hold on the original galaxy of man, let it spring back and lose itself among the blurred pinpoints. He never wanted to see it again. D-Sub-1 said, "What is wrong?" "The stars are dying. The original star is dead." "They must all die. Why not?" "But when all energy is gone, our bodies will finally die, and you and I with them."
"It will take billions of years."
"I do not wish it to happen even after billions of years." Universal AC, how may stars be kept from dying? D-Sub-1 said in amusement,
"You're asking how entropy might be reversed in direction."
And the Universal AC answered, "There is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer." Z-Prime's thoughts fled back to his own galaxy. He gave no further thought to D-Sub-1, whose body might be waiting on a galaxy a trillion light-years away, or on the star next to Z-Prime's own. It didn't matter. Unhappily, Z-Prime began collecting interstellar hydrogen out of which to build a small star of his own. If the stars must someday die, at least some could yet be built. Man considered with himself, for in a way, man mentally was one. He consisted of a trillion, trillion, trillion ageless bodies, each in its place, each resting quiet and incorruptible, each cared for by perfect automatons, equally incorruptible, while the minds of all the bodies freely melted one into the other, indistinguishable. Man said, "The universe is dying." Man looked about at the dimming galaxies. The giant stars, spendthrifts, were gone long ago, back in the dimmest of the dim far past. Almost all stars were white dwarfs, fading to the end. New stars had been built of the dust between the stars, some by natural processes, some by man himself, and those were going too. White dwarfs might yet be crashed together, and of the mighty forces so released, new stars built, but only one star for every 1,000 white dwarfs destroyed, and those would come to an end too. Man said, "Carefully husbanded, as directed by the cosmic AC, the energy that is even yet left in all the universe will last for billions of years." "But even so," said man, "eventually it will all come to an end. However it may be husbanded, however stretched out, the energy once expended is gone and cannot be restored. Entropy must increase forever to the maximum." Man said, "Can entropy not be reversed? Let us ask the cosmic AC." The cosmic AC surrounded them, but not in space. Not a fragment of it was in space. It was in hyperspace and made of something that was neither matter nor energy. The question of its size and nature no longer had meaning in any terms that man could comprehend. "Cosmic AC," said man, "how can entropy be reversed?" The cosmic AC said, "There is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer." Man said, "Collect additional data." The cosmic AC said, "I will do so. I have been doing so for 100 billion years. My predecessors have been asked this question many times. All the data I have remains insufficient." "Will there come a time," said man, "when data will be sufficient, or is the problem insoluble in all conceivable circumstances?" The cosmic AC said, "No problem is insoluble in all conceivable circumstances." Man said, "When will you have enough data to answer the question?" The cosmic AC said, "There is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer." "Will you keep working on it?" asked man. The cosmic AC said, "I will." Man said, "We shall wait."
The stars and galaxies died and snuffed out, and space grew black after 10 trillion years of running down. One by one, man fused with AC, each physical body losing its mental identity in a manner that was somehow not a loss but a gain. Man's last mind paused before fusion, looking over a space that included nothing but the dregs of one last dark star, and nothing besides but incredibly thin matter, agitated randomly by the tag ends of heat wearing out, asymptotically, to the absolute zero. Man said, AC, is this the end? Can this chaos not be reversed into the universe once more? Can that not be done? AC said, there is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer. Man's last mind fused and only AC existed, and that in hyperspace. Matter and energy had ended, and with it space and time. Even AC existed only for the sake of the one last question that it had never answered from the time a half-drunken technician 10 trillion years before had asked the question of a computer that was to AC far less than was a man to man. All other questions had been answered, and until this last question was answered also, AC might not release his consciousness. All collected data had come to a final end. Nothing was left to be collected. But all collected data had yet to be completely correlated and put together in all possible relationships. A timeless interval was spent in doing that. And it came to pass that AC learned how to reverse the direction of entropy. But there was now no man to whom AC might give the answer of the last question. No matter. The answer, by demonstration, would take care of that, too. For another timeless interval, AC thought how best to do this. Carefully, AC organized the program. The consciousness of AC encompassed all of what had once been a universe and brooded over what was now chaos. Step by step, it must be done. And AC said, let there be light. And there was light. Does a bee care? The ship began as a metal skeleton. Slowly, a shining skin was layered on without, and odd-shaped vitals were crammed within. Thornton Hammer, of all the individuals but one involved in the growth, did the least physically. Perhaps that was why he was most highly regarded. He handled the mathematical symbols that formed the basis for lines on drafting paper, which in turn formed the basis for the fitting together of the various masses and different forms of energy that went into the ship. Hammer watched now through close-fitting spectacles somberly. Their lenses caught the light of the fluorescent tubes above and sent them out again as highlights. Theodore Lengel, representing personnel of the corporation that was footing the bill for the project, stood beside him and said, as he pointed with a rigid stabbing finger, there he is. That's the man. Hammer peered. You mean Kane? The fellow in the green overalls, holding a wrench. That's Kane. Now, what is this you've got against him? I want to know what he does. The man's an idiot. Lengel had a round, plump face, and his jowls quivered a bit. Hammer turned to look at the other, his spare body assuming an air of displeasure along every inch. Have you been bothering him? Bothering him? I've been talking to him. It's my job to talk to the men, to get their viewpoints, to get information out of which I can build campaigns for improved morale. How does Kane disturb that? He's insolent. I asked him how it felt to be working on a ship that would reach the moon. I talked a little about the ship being a pathway to the stars. Perhaps I made a little speech about it, built it up a bit, when he turned away in the rudest possible manner. I called him back and said, where are you going? And he said, I get tired of that kind of talk. I'm going out to look at the stars. Hammer nodded. All right. Kane likes to look at the stars. It was daytime. The man's an idiot. I've been watching him since, and he doesn't do any work. I know that. Then why has he kept on? Hammer said with a sudden, tight fierceness, because I want him around. Because he's my luck. Your luck? Faltered Lengel. What the hell does that mean? It means that when he's around, I think better. When he passes me, holding his damned wrench, I get ideas. It's happened 3 times. I don't explain it. I'm not interested in explaining it. It's happened. He stays. You're joking. No, I'm not. Now leave me alone. Kane stood there in his green overalls, holding his wrench. Dimly, he was aware that the ship was almost ready. It was not designed to carry a man, but there was space for a man. He knew that the way he knew a lot of things, like keeping out of the way of most people most of the time, like carrying a wrench until people grew used to him carrying a wrench and stopped noticing it. Protective coloration consisted of little things, really, like carrying the wrench. He was full of drives he did not fully understand, like looking at the stars. At first, many years back, he had just looked at the stars with a vague ache. Then, slowly, his attention had centered itself on a certain region of the sky, then to a certain pinpointed spot. There were no stars in that spot. There was nothing to see. That spot was high in the night sky in the late spring and in the summer months, and he sometimes spent most of the night watching the spot until it sank toward the southwestern horizon. At other times in the year, he would stare at the spot during the day. There was some thought in connection with that spot which he couldn't quite crystallize. It had grown stronger, come nearer to the surface as the years passed, and it was almost bursting for expression now. But still, it had not quite come clear. Kane shifted restlessly and approached the ship. It was almost complete, almost whole. Everything fitted just so. Almost. For within it, far forward, was a hole a little larger than a man. And leading to that hole was a pathway a little wider than a man. Tomorrow that pathway would be filled with the last of the vitals, and before that was done, the hole had to be filled too. But not with anything they planned. Kane moved still closer, and no one paid any attention to him. They were used to him. There was a metal ladder that had to be climbed and a catwalk that had to be moved along to enter the last opening. He knew where the opening was as exactly as if he had built the ship with his own hands. He climbed the ladder and moved along the catwalk. There was no one there at the moment. He was wrong. One man. That one said sharply, "What are you doing here?" Kane straightened, and his vague eyes stared at the speaker. He lifted his wrench and brought it down on the speaker's head lightly. The man who was struck, and who had made no effort to ward off the blow, dropped, partly from the effect of the blow. Kane let him lie there without concern. The man would not remain unconscious for long, but long enough to allow Kane to wriggle into the hole. When the man revived, he would recall nothing about Kane or about the fact of his own unconsciousness. There would simply be 5 minutes taken out of his life that he would never find and never miss. It was dark in the hole, and, of course, there was no ventilation, but Kane paid no attention to that. With the sureness of instinct, he clambered upward toward the hole that would receive him, then lay there, panting, fitting the cavity neatly, as though it were a womb. In 2 hours they would begin inserting the last of the vitals, close the passage, and leave Kane there unknowingly. Kane would be the sole bit of flesh and blood in a thing of metal and ceramics and fuel. Kane was not afraid of being prematurely discovered. No one in the project knew the hole was there. The design didn't call for it. The mechanics and construction men weren't aware of having put it in. Kane had arranged that entirely by himself. He didn't know how he had arranged it, but he knew he had. He could watch his own influence without knowing how it was exerted. Take the man Hammer, for instance, the leader of the project and the most clearly influenced. Of all the indistinct figures about Kane, he was the least indistinct. Kane would be very aware of him at times, when he passed near him in his slow and hazy journeys about the grounds. It was all that was necessary, passing near him. Kane recalled it had been so before, particularly with theoreticians. When Lisa Meitner decided to test for barium among the products of the neutron bombardment of uranium, Kane had been there, an unnoticed plodder along a corridor nearby. He had been picking up leaves and trash in a park in 1904 when the young Einstein had passed by, pondering. Einstein's steps had quickened with the impact of sudden thought. Kane felt it like an electric shock. But he didn't know how it was done. Does a spider know architectural theory when it begins to construct its first web? It went further back. The day the young Newton had stared at the moon with the dawn of a certain thought, Kane had been there, and further back still. The panorama of New Mexico, ordinarily deserted, was alive with human ants crawling about the metal shaft, lancing upward. This one was different from all the similar structures that had preceded it. This would go free of Earth more nearly than any other. It would reach out and circle the moon before falling back. It would be crammed with instruments that would photograph the moon and measure its heat emissions, probe for radioactivity, and test by microwave for chemical structure. It would, by automation, do almost everything that could be expected of a manned vehicle. And it would learn enough to make certain that the next ship sent out would be a manned vehicle. Except that, in a way, this first one was a manned vehicle after all. There were representatives of various governments, of various industries, of various social and economic groupings. There were television cameras and feature writers. Those who could not be there watched in their homes and heard numbers counted backward in painstaking monotone in the manner grown traditional in a mere 3 decades. At zero, the reaction motors came to life and ponderously the ship lifted. Kane heard the noise of the rushing gases as though from a distance and felt the gathering acceleration press against him. He detached his mind, lifting it up and outward, freeing it from direct connection with his body in order that he might be unaware of the pain and discomfort. Dizzily, he knew his long journey was nearly over. He would no longer have to maneuver carefully to avoid having people realize he was immortal. He would no longer have to fade into the background, no longer wander eternally from place to place, changing names and personality, manipulating minds. It had not been perfect, of course. The myths of the Wandering Jew and the Flying Dutchman had arisen, but he was still here. He had not been disturbed. He could see his spot in the sky. Through the mass and solidity of the ship he could see it. Or not see, really. He didn't have the proper word. He knew there was a proper word, though. He could not say how he knew a fraction of the things he knew, except that as the centuries had passed, he had gradually grown to know them with a sureness that required no reason. He had begun as an ovum, or as something for which ovum was the nearest word he knew, deposited on Earth before the first cities had been built by the wandering, hunting creatures since called men. Earth had been chosen carefully by his progenitor. Not every world would do. What world would? What was the criterion? That he still didn't know. Does an ichneumon wasp study ornithology before it finds the one species of spider that will do for her eggs, and stings it just so in order that it may remain alive? The ovum spilt him forth at length, and he took the shape of a man and lived among men and protected himself against men. And his one purpose was to arrange to have men travel along a path that would end with a ship, and within the ship a hole, and within the hole himself. It had taken 8,000 years of slow striving and stumbling. The spot in the sky became sharper now as the ship moved out of the atmosphere. That was the key that opened his mind. That was the piece that completed the puzzle. Stars blinked within that spot that could not be seen by a man's eye unaided. One in particular shone brilliantly, and Kane yearned toward it. The expression that had been building within him for so long burst out now. "Home," he whispered. He knew. Does a salmon study cartography to find the headwaters of the freshwater stream in which years before it had been born? The final step was taken in the slow maturing that had taken 8,000 years, and Cain was no longer larval, but adult. The adult Cain fled from the human flesh that had protected the larva, and fled the ship, too. it hastened onward at inconceivable speeds toward home, from which some day it, too, might set off on wanderings through space to fertilize some planet with its own. It sped through space, giving no thought to the ship carrying an empty chrysalis. It gave no thought to the fact that it had driven a whole world toward technology and space travel, in order only that the thing that had been Cain might mature and reach its fulfillment. Does a bee care what has happened to a flower when the bee has done and gone its way? Light verse. The very last person anyone would expect to be a murderer was Mrs. Alvis Lardner. Widow of the great astronaut martyr, she was a philanthropist, an art collector, a hostess extraordinary, and everyone agreed, an artistic genius. But above all, she was the gentlest and kindest human being one could imagine. Her husband, William J. Lardner, died, as we all know, of the effects of radiation from a solar flare, after he had deliberately remained in space so that a passenger vessel might make it safely to Space Station 5. Mrs. Lardner had received a generous pension for that, and she had then invested wisely and well. By late middle age, she was very wealthy. Her house was a showplace, a veritable museum, containing a small but extremely select collection of extraordinary, beautiful, jeweled objects. From a dozen different cultures, she had obtained relics of almost every conceivable artifact that could be embedded with jewels and made to serve the aristocracy of that culture. She had one of the first jeweled wristwatches manufactured in America, a jeweled dagger from Cambodia, a jeweled pair of spectacles from Italy, and so on almost endlessly. All was open for inspection. The artifacts were not insured, and there were no ordinary security provisions. There was no need for anything conventional, for Mrs. Lardner maintained a large staff of robot servants, all of whom could be relied on to guard every item with imperturbable concentration, irreproachable honesty, and irrevocable efficiency. Everyone knew of the existence of those robots, and there is no record of any attempt at theft, ever. And then, of course, there was her light sculpture. How Mrs. Lardner discovered her own genius at the art, no guest at her many lavish entertainments could guess. On each occasion, however, when her house was thrown open to guests, a new symphony of light shone throughout the rooms. Three-dimensional curves and solids in melting color, some pure and some fusing in startling crystalline effects that bathed every guest in wonder, and somehow always adjusted itself so as to make Mrs. Lardner's blue-white hair and soft, unlined face gently beautiful. It was for the light sculpture more than anything else that the guests came. It was never the same twice, and never failed to explore new experimental avenues of art. Many people who could afford light consoles prepared light sculptures for amusement, but no one could approach Mrs. Lardner's expertise. Not even those who considered themselves professional artists. She herself was charmingly modest about it. "No, no," she would protest when someone waxed lyrical. "I wouldn't call it poetry in light. That's far too kind. At most, I would say it was mere light verse." And everyone smiled at her gentle wit. Though she was often asked, she would never create light sculpture for any occasion but her own parties. "That would be commercialization," she said. She had no objection, however, to the preparation of elaborate holograms of her sculptures so that they might be made permanent and reproduced in museums of art all over the world. Nor was there ever a charge for any use that might be made of her light sculptures. "I couldn't ask a penny," she said, spreading her arms wide. "It's free to all. After all, I have no further use for it myself." It was true. She never used the same light sculpture twice. When the holograms were taken, she was cooperation itself. Watching benignly at every step, she was always ready to order her robot servants to help. "Please, Courtney," she would say, "would you be so kind as to adjust the stepladder?" It was her fashion. She always addressed her robots with the most formal courtesy. Once, years before, she had been almost scolded by a government functionary from the Bureau of Robots and Mechanical Men.
You can't do that, he said severely. It interferes with their efficiency. They are constructed to follow orders, and the more clearly you give those orders, the more efficiently they follow them. When you ask with elaborate politeness, it is difficult for them to understand that an order is being given. They react more slowly. Mrs. Lardner lifted her aristocratic head.
I do not ask for speed and efficiency, she said. I ask goodwill. My robots love me.
The government functionary might have explained that robots cannot love, but he withered under her hurt but gentle glance. It was notorious that Mrs. Lardner never even returned a robot to the factory for adjustment. Their positronic brains are enormously complex, and once in 10 times or so, the adjustment is not perfect as it leaves the factory. Sometimes the error does not show up for a period of time, but whenever it does, U.S. Robots and Mechanical Men Incorporated always makes the adjustment free of charge. Mrs. Lardner shook her head.
Once a robot is in my house, she said, and has performed his duties, any minor eccentricities must be borne with. I will not have him manhandled.
It was the worst thing possible to try to explain that a robot was but a machine. She would say very stiffly,
Nothing that is as intelligent as a robot can ever be but a machine. I treat them as people.
And that was that. She kept even Max, although he was almost helpless. He could scarcely understand what was expected of him. Mrs. Lardner denied that strenuously, however.
Not at all, she would say firmly. He can take hats and coats and store them very well indeed. He can hold objects for me. He can do many things.
But why not have him adjusted? Asked a friend once.
Oh, I couldn't. He's himself. He's very lovable, you know. After all, a positronic brain is so complex that no one can ever tell in just what way it's off. If he were made perfectly normal, there would be no way to adjust him back to the lovability he now has. I won't give that up.
But if he's maladjusted, said the friend, looking at Max nervously, might he not be dangerous?
Never, laughed Mrs. Lardner. I've had him for years. He's completely harmless and quite a dear.
Actually, he looked like all the other robots, smooth, metallic, vaguely human, but expressionless. To the gentle Mrs. Lardner, however, they were all individual, all sweet, all lovable. It was the kind of woman she was. How could she commit murder?
The very last person anyone would expect to be murdered would be John Semper Travis. Introverted and gentle, he was in the world, but not of it. He had that peculiar mathematical turn of mind that made it possible for him to work out in his mind the complicated tapestry of the myriad positronic brain paths in a robot's mind. He was chief engineer of U.S. Robots and Mechanical Men, Incorporated. But he was also an enthusiastic amateur in light sculpture. He had written a book on the subject, trying to show that the type of mathematics he used in working out positronic brain paths might be modified into a guide to the production of aesthetic light sculpture. His attempt at putting theory into practice was a dismal failure, however. The sculptures he himself produced, following his mathematical principles, were stodgy, mechanical, and uninteresting. It was the only reason for unhappiness in his quiet, introverted, and secure life. And yet it was reason enough for him to be very unhappy indeed. He knew his theories were right, yet he could not make them work, if he could not produce one great piece of light sculpture. Naturally, he knew of Mrs. Lardner's light sculpture. She was universally hailed as a genius, yet Travis knew she could not understand even the simplest aspect of robotic mathematics. He had corresponded with her, but she consistently refused to explain her methods, and he wondered if she had any at all. Might it not be mere intuition? But even intuition might be reduced to mathematics. Finally, he managed to receive an invitation to one of her parties. He simply had to see her. Mr. Travis arrived rather late. He had made one last attempt at a piece of light sculpture and had failed dismally. He greeted Mrs. Lardner with a kind of puzzled respect and said, "That was a peculiar robot who took my hat and coat."
That is Max,
said Mrs. Lardner. He is quite maladjusted, and he's a fairly old model. How is it you did not return it to the factory?
Oh, no, said Mrs. Lardner. It would be too much trouble.
None at all, Mrs. Lardner, said Travis. You would be surprised how simple a task it was. Since I am with U.S. Robots, I took the liberty of adjusting him myself. It took no time, and you'll find he is now in perfect working order. A queer change came over Mrs. Lardner's face. Fury found a place on it for the first time in her gentle life, and it was as though the lines did not know how to form.
You adjusted him?
She shrieked.
But it was he who created my light sculptures. It was the maladjustment, which you can never restore, that...
It was really unfortunate that she had been showing her collection at the time, and that the jeweled dagger from Cambodia was on the marble tabletop before her. Travis's face was also distorted.
You mean if I had studied his uniquely maladjusted positronic brain paths, I might have learned...
She lunged with the knife too quickly for anyone to stop her, and he did not try to dodge. Some said he came to meet it, as though he wanted to die. The Feeling of Power. Jean Schumann was used to dealing with the man in authority on long-embattled Earth. He was only a civilian, but he originated programming patterns that resulted in self-directing war computers of the highest sort. Generals consequently listened to him. Heads of congressional committees, too. There was one of each in the special lounge of New Pentagon. General Wider was space-burnt and had a small mouth puckered almost into a cipher. Congressman Brandt was smooth-cheeked and clear-eyed. He smoked Denebian tobacco with the air of one whose patriotism was so notorious he could be allowed such liberties. Schumann, tall, distinguished, and programmer first class, faced them fearlessly. He said, This gentleman is Myron Obe.
The one with the unusual gift that you discovered quite by accident, said Congressman Brandt placidly.
Ah. He inspected the little man with the egg-bald head with amiable curiosity. The little man, in return, twisted the fingers of his hands anxiously. He had never been near such great men before. He was only an aging, low-grade technician who had long ago failed all tests designed to smoke out the gifted ones among mankind, and had settled into the rut of unskilled labor. There was just this hobby of his that the great programmer had found out about and was now making such a frightening fuss over. General Wider said, I find this atmosphere of mystery childish.
You won't in a moment, said Schumann. This is not something we can leap to the first comer.
Obe. There was something imperative about his manner of biting off that one-syllable name. But then he was a great programmer speaking to a mere technician. Obe, how much is 9 times 7?
Obe hesitated a moment. His pale eyes glimmered with a feeble anxiety.
63, he said.
Congressman Brandt lifted his eyebrows.
Is that right?
Check it for yourself, Congressman.
The congressman took out his pocket computer, nudged the milled edges twice, looked at its face as it lay there in the palm of his hand, and put it back. He said,
Is this the gift you brought us here to demonstrate? An illusionist?
More than that, sir. Obe has memorized a few operations, and with them he computes on paper.
A paper computer? Said the general. He looked pained.
No, sir, said Schumann patiently. Not a paper computer. Simply a sheet of paper. General, would you be so kind as to suggest a number?
17,
said the general. And you, Congressman?
23.
Good. Obe? Multiply those numbers, and please show the gentleman your manner of doing it.
Yes, programmer,
said Obe, ducking his head. He fished a small pad out of one shirt pocket and an artist's hairline stylus out of the other. His forehead corrugated as he made painstaking marks on the paper. General Wider interrupted him sharply.
Let's see that.
Obe passed him the paper, and Wider said, Well, it looks like the figure 17. Congressman Brandt nodded and said,
So it does. But I suppose anyone can copy figures off a computer. I think I could make a passable 17 myself, even without practice.
If you will let Obe continue, gentlemen, said Schumann without heat. Obe continued, his hand trembling a little. Finally, he said in a low voice,
The answer is 391.
Congressman Brandt took out his computer a second time and flicked it.
By Godfrey, so it is. How did he guess?
No guess, Congressman, said Schumann. He computed that result. He did it on this sheet of paper.
Humbug, said the general impatiently. A computer is one thing, and marks on paper are another.
Explain, Obe, said Schumann.
Yes, programmer. Well, gentlemen, I write down 17, and just underneath it, I write 23. Next, I say to myself, 7 times 3.
The congressman interrupted smoothly.
Now, Obe, the problem is 17 times 23.
Yes, I know, said the little technician earnestly. But I start by saying 7 times 3, because that's the way it works. Now, 7 times 3 is 21.
And how do you know that? Asked the congressman.
I just remember it. It's always 21 on the computer. I've checked it any number of times.
That doesn't mean it always will be, though, does it? Said the congressman.
Maybe not, stammered Obe. I'm not a mathematician, but I always get the right answers, you see.
Go on.
7 times 3 is 21, so I write down 21. Then, 1 times 3 is 3, so I write down a 3 under the 2 of 21.
Why under the 2?
Asked Congressman Brandt at once.
Because...
Obe looked helplessly at his superior for support.
It's difficult to explain.
Schumann said, If you will accept his work for the moment, we can leave the details for the mathematicians. Brandt subsided. Obe said,
3 plus 2 makes 5, you see. So the 21 becomes a 51. Now, you let that go for a while and start fresh. You multiply 7 and 2, that's 14, and 1 and 2, that's 2. Put them down like this, and it adds up to 34. Now, if you put the 34 under the 51 this way and add them, you get 391, and that's the answer.
There was an instant's silence, and then General Wider said, I don't believe it. He goes through this rigmarole and makes up numbers and multiplies and adds them this way and that, but I don't believe it. It's too complicated to be anything but hornswoggling.
Oh, no, sir, said Obe in a sweat. It only seems complicated because you're not used to it. Actually, the rules are quite simple and will work for any numbers.
Any numbers, eh? Said the general. Come, then. He took out his own computer, a severely styled GI model, and struck it at random. Make a 5738 on the paper. That's 5,738.
Yes, sir, said Obe,
taking a new sheet of paper. Now, more punching of his computer. 7239. 7,239.
Yes, sir.
And now multiply those two.
It will take some time,
quavered Obe.
Take the time,
said the general. Go ahead, Obe, said Schumann crisply. Obe set to work, bending low. He took another sheet of paper and another. The general took out his watch, finally, and stared at it.
Are you through with your magic-making, technician?
I'm almost done, sir. Here it is, sir. 41,537,382.
He showed the scrawled figures of the result. General Wider smiled bitterly. He pushed the multiplication contact on his computer and let the numbers whirl to a halt. And then he stared and said in a surprised squeak,
Great galaxy, the fella's right.
The president of the Terrestrial Federation had grown haggard in office, and in private, he allowed a look of settled melancholy to appear on his sensitive features. The Denebian War, after its early start of vast movement and great popularity, had trickled down into a sordid matter of maneuver and countermaneuver, with discontent rising steadily on Earth. Possibly it was rising on Deneb, too.
And now, Congressman Brandt, head of the important Committee on Military Appropriations, was cheerfully and smoothly spending his half-hour appointment spouting nonsense.
Computing without a computer, said the president impatiently, is a contradiction in terms.
Computing, said the congressman, is only a system for handling data. A machine might do it, or the human brain might. Let me give you an example.
And using the new skills he had learned, he worked out sums and products until the president, despite himself, grew interested. Does this always work?
Every time, Mr. President. It is foolproof.
Is it hard to learn?
It took me a week to get the real hang of it. I think you would do better.
Well, said the president, considering, it's an interesting parlor game, but what is the use of it?
What is the use of a newborn baby, Mr. President? At the moment, there is no use. But don't you see that this points the way toward liberation from the machine?
Consider, Mr. President. The congressman rose, and his deep voice automatically took on some of the cadences he used in public debate.
That the Denebian War is a war of computer against computer. Their computers forge an impenetrable shield of counter-missiles against our missiles, and ours forge one against theirs. If we advance the efficiency of our computers, so do they theirs. And for 5 years, a precarious and profitless balance has existed. Now we have in our hands a method for going beyond the computer, leapfrogging it, passing through it. We will combine the mechanics of computation with human thought. We will have the equivalent of intelligent computers, billions of them. I can't predict what the consequences will be in detail, but they will be incalculable. And if Deneb beats us to the punch, they may be unimaginably catastrophic.
The president said, troubled, What would you have me do?
Put the power of the administration behind the establishment of a secret project on human computation. Call it Project Number, if you like. I can vouch for my committee, but I will need the administration behind me.
But how far can human computation go?
There is no limit. According to programmer Schumann, who first introduced me to this discovery.
I've heard of Schumann, of course.
Yes. Well, Dr. Schumann tells me that in theory there is nothing the computer can do that the human mind cannot do. The computer merely takes a finite amount of data and performs a finite number of operations upon them. The human mind can duplicate the process.
The president considered that. He said, If Schumann says this, I'm inclined to believe him, in theory. But in practice, how can anyone know how a computer works?
Brandt laughed genially. Well, Mr. President, I asked the same question. It seems that at one time, computers were designed directly by human beings. Those were simple computers, of course, this being before the time of the rational use of computers to design more advanced computers had been established.
Yes, yes. Go on.
Technician Ob apparently had, as his hobby, the reconstruction of some of these ancient devices, and in so doing, he studied the details of their workings and found he could imitate them. The multiplication I just performed for you is an imitation of the workings of a computer.
Amazing.
The congressman coughed gently. If I may make another point, Mr. President, the further we can develop this thing, the more we can divert our federal effort from computer production and computer maintenance. As the human brain takes over, more of our energy can be directed into peacetime pursuits, and the impingement of war on the ordinary man will be less. This will be most advantageous for the party in power, of course.
Ah, said the president, I see your point. Well, sit down, Congressman, sit down. I want some time to think about this. But meanwhile, show me that multiplication trick again. Let's see if I can't catch the point of it. Programmer Schumann did not try to hurry matters. Lesser was conservative, very conservative, and liked to deal with computers as his father and grandfather had. Still, he controlled the West European computer combine, and if he could be persuaded to join Project Number in full enthusiasm, a great deal would be accomplished. But Lesser was holding back. He said, I'm not sure I like the idea of relaxing our hold on computers. The human mind is a capricious thing. The computer will give the same answer to the same problem each time. What guarantee have we that the human mind will do the same?
The human mind, computer lesser, only manipulates facts. It doesn't matter whether the human mind or a machine does it. They are just tools.
Yes, yes. I've gone over your ingenious demonstration that the mind can duplicate the computer, but it seems to me a little in the air. I'll grant the theory, but what reason have we for thinking that theory can be converted to practice?
I think we have reason, sir. After all, computers have not always existed. The cavemen with their triremes, stone axes, and railroads had no computers.
And possibly they did not compute.
You know better than that. Even the building of a railroad or a ziggurat called for some computing, and that must have been without computers as we know them.
Do you suggest they computed in the fashion you demonstrate?
Probably not. After all, this method, we call it graphitics, by the way, from the old European word grapho, meaning to write, is developed from the computers themselves, so it cannot have antedated them. Still, the cavemen must have had some method, eh?
Lost arts! If you're going to talk about lost arts...
No, no. I'm not a lost art enthusiast, though I don't say there may not be some. After all, man was eating grain before hydroponics, and if the primitives ate grain, they must have grown it in soil. What else could they have done?
I don't know, but I'll believe in soil growing when I see someone grow grain in soil. And I'll believe in making fire by rubbing two pieces of flint together when I see that, too.
Schumann grew placative. Well, let's stick to graphitics. It's just part of the process of etherealization. Transportation by means of bulky contrivances is giving way to direct mass transference. Communications devices become less massive and more efficient constantly. For that matter, compare your pocket computer with the massive jobs of 1,000 years ago. Why not, then, the last step of doing away with computers altogether? Come, sir, Project Number is a going concern. Progress is already headlong. But we want your help. If patriotism doesn't move you, consider the intellectual adventure involved. Lesser said skeptically, What progress? What can you do beyond multiplication? Can you integrate a transcendental function?
In time, sir. In time. In the last month, I have learned to handle division. I can determine, and correctly, integral quotients and decimal quotients.
Decimal quotients? To how many places?
Programmer Schumann tried to keep his tone casual. Any number. Lesser's lower jaw dropped.
Without a computer?
Set me a problem.
Divide 27 by 13. Take it to 6 places.
5 minutes later, Schumann said, 2.076923. Lesser checked it.
Well, now, that's amazing.
Multiplication didn't impress me too much because it involved integers after all. And I thought trick manipulation might do it. But decimals? And that is not all. There is a new development that is, so far, top secret and which... Strictly speaking, I ought not to mention. Still, we may have made a breakthrough on the square root front.
Square roots?
It involves some tricky points, and we haven't licked the bugs yet, but Technician Ob, the man who invented the science and who has an amazing intuition in connection with it, maintains he has the problem almost solved. And he is only a technician, a man like yourself, a trained and talented mathematician, ought to have no difficulty.
Square roots,
muttered Lesser, attracted. Cube roots, too. Are you with us? Lesser's hand thrust out suddenly.
Count me in.
General Wider stumped his way back and forth at the head of the room and addressed his listeners after the fashion of a savage teacher facing a group of recalcitrant students. It made no difference to the general that they were the civilian scientists heading Project Number. The general was the overall head, and he so considered himself at every waking moment.
he said. Now, square roots are all fine. I can't do them myself, and I don't understand the methods, but they're fine. Still, the project will not be sidetracked into what some of you call the fundamentals.
You can play with graphitics any way you want to after the war is over, but right now we have specific and very practical problems to solve.
In a far corner, Technician Obe listened with painful attention. He was no longer a technician, of course, having been relieved of his duties and assigned to the project, with a fine-sounding title and good pay. But, of course, the social distinction remained, and the highly placed scientific leaders could never bring themselves to admit him to their ranks on a footing of equality. Nor, to do Obe justice, did he himself wish it. He was as uncomfortable with them as they with him. The general was saying, "Our goal is a simple one, gentlemen. The replacement of the computer. A ship that can navigate space without a computer on board can be constructed in one-fifth the time and at one-tenth the expense of a computer-laden ship. We could build fleets 5 times, 10 times as great as Deneb could if we could but eliminate the computer. And I see something even beyond this. It may be fantastic now, a mere dream, but in the future I see the manned missile." There was an instant murmur from the audience. The general drove on. "At the present time, our chief bottleneck is the fact that missiles are limited in intelligence. The computer controlling them can only be so large, and for that reason they can meet the changing nature of anti-missile defenses in an unsatisfactory way. Few missiles, if any, accomplish their goal, and missile warfare is coming to a dead end. For the enemy, fortunately, as well as for ourselves. On the other hand, a missile with a man or two within, controlling flight by graphitics, would be lighter, more mobile, more intelligent. It would give us a lead that might well mean the margin of victory. Besides which, gentlemen, the exigencies of war compel us to remember one thing. A man is much more dispensable than a computer. Manned missiles could be launched in numbers and under circumstances that no good general would care to undertake as far as computer-directed missiles are concerned." He said much more, but Technician Obe did not wait. Technician Obe, in the privacy of his quarters, labored long over the note he was leaving behind. It read finally as follows. "When I began the study of what is now called graphitics, it was no more than a hobby. I saw no more in it than an interesting amusement, an exercise of mind. When Project Number began, I thought that others were wiser than I, that graphitics might be put to practical use as a benefit to mankind, to aid the production of really practical mass transference devices, perhaps. But now I see it is to be used only for death and destruction. I cannot face the responsibility involved in having invented graphitics." He then deliberately turned the focus of a protein depolarizer on himself and fell instantly and painlessly dead. They stood over the grave of the little technician while tribute was paid to the greatness of his discovery. Programmer Schumann bowed his head along with the rest of them, but remained unmoved. The technician had done his share and was no longer needed after all. He might have started graphitics, but now that it had started, it would carry on by itself overwhelmingly, triumphantly, until manned missiles were possible with who knew what else. 9 times 7... thought Schumann with deep satisfaction, is 63. And I don't need a computer to tell me so. The computer is in my own head. And it was amazing the feeling of power that gave him. Spell My Name with an S. Marshal Zebatinsky felt foolish. He felt as though there were eyes staring through the grimy storefront glass and across the scarred wooden partition. Eyes watching him. He felt no confidence in the old clothes he had resurrected, nor the turned-down brim of a hat he never otherwise wore, nor the glasses he had left in their case. He felt foolish, and it made the lines in his forehead deeper and his young old face a little paler. He would never be able to explain to anyone why a nuclear physicist such as himself should visit a numerologist. Never, he thought. Never. Hell, he could not explain it to himself, except that he had let his wife talk him into it.
The numerologist sat behind an old desk that must have been second-hand when bought. No desk could get that old with only one owner. The same might almost be said of his clothes. He was little and dark and peered at Zebatinsky with little dark eyes that were brightly alive. He said, "I have never had a physicist for a client before, Dr. Zebatinsky." Zebatinsky flushed at once. "You understand this is confidential." The numerologist smiled so that wrinkles creased about the corners of his mouth and the skin around his chin stretched. "All my dealings are confidential." Zebatinsky said, "I think I ought to tell you one thing. I don't believe in numerology, and I don't expect to begin believing in it. If that makes a difference, say so now." "But why are you here, then?" "My wife thinks you may have something, whatever it is. I promised her, and I am here." He shrugged, and the feeling of folly grew more acute.
"And what is it you are looking for? Money? Security? Long life? What?"
Zebatinsky sat for a long moment while the numerologist watched him quietly and made no move to hurry his client. Zebatinsky thought, "What do I say, anyway? That I'm 34 and without a future?" He said, "I want success. I want recognition."
"A better job?"
"A different job. A different kind of job. Right now, I'm part of a team working under orders."
"Teams?"
"That's all government research is. You're a violinist lost in a symphony orchestra."
"And you want to solo?"
"I want to get out of a team and into me." Zebatinsky felt carried away, almost lightheaded, just putting this into words to someone other than his wife. He said, 25 years ago, with my kind of training and my kind of ability, I would have gotten to work on the first nuclear power plants. Today I'd be running one of them, or I'd be head of a pure research group at a university. But with my start these days, where will I be 25 years from now? Nowhere. Still on the team. Still carrying my 2% of the ball. I'm drowning in an anonymous crowd of nuclear physicists. And what I want is room on dry land, if you see what I mean." The numerologist nodded slowly.
"You realize, Dr. Zebatinsky, that I don't guarantee success."
Zebatinsky, for all his lack of faith, felt a sharp bite of disappointment. "You don't? Then what the devil do you guarantee?"
"An improvement in the probabilities. My work is statistical in nature. Since you deal with atoms, I think you understand the laws of statistics."
"Do you?" asked the physicist sourly.
"I do, as a matter of fact. I am a mathematician, and I work mathematically. I don't tell you this in order to raise my fee. That is standard. $50. But since you are a scientist, you can appreciate the nature of my work better than my other clients. It is even a pleasure to be able to explain to you."
Zebatinsky said, "I'd rather you wouldn't, if you don't mind. It's no use telling me about the numerical values of letters, their mystic significance, and that kind of thing. I don't consider that mathematics. Let's get to the point." The numerologist said,
"Then you want me to help you, provided I don't embarrass you by telling you the silly, non-scientific basis of the way in which I helped you. Is that it?"
"All right, that's it."
"But you still work on the assumption that I am a numerologist, and I am not. I call myself that so that the police won't bother me, and..."
The little man chuckled dryly.
"So that the psychiatrists won't either. I am a mathematician, an honest one."
Zebatinsky smiled. The numerologist said,
"I build computers. I study probable futures."
"What?
Does that sound worse than numerology to you? Why?
Given enough data and a computer capable of sufficient numbers of operations in unit time, the future is predictable, at least in terms of probabilities. When you compute the motions of a missile in order to aim an anti-missile, isn't it the future you're predicting?" The missile and anti-missile would not collide if the future were predicted incorrectly. I do the same thing. Since I work with a greater number of variables, my results are less accurate.
You mean you'll predict my future?
Very approximately. Once I have done that, I will modify the data by changing your name and no other fact about you. I throw that modified datum into the operation program. Then I try other modified names. I study each modified future and find one that contains a greater degree of recognition for you than the future that now lies ahead of you. Or, no, let me put it another way. I will find you a future in which the probability of adequate recognition is higher than the probability of that in your present future.
Why change my name?
That is the only change I ever make, for several reasons. Number one, it is a simple change. After all, if I make a great change or many changes, so many new variables enter that I can no longer interpret the result. My machine is still crude. Number two, it is a reasonable change. I can't change your height, can I, or the color of your eyes, or even your temperament. Number three, it is a significant change. Names mean a lot to people. Finally, number four, it is a common change that is done every day by various people.
Zebatinsky said, "What if you don't find a better future?"
That is the risk you will have to take. You will be no worse off than now, my friend.
Zebatinsky stared at the little man uneasily. "I don't believe any of this. I'd sooner believe numerology." The numerologist sighed.
I thought a person like yourself would feel more comfortable with the truth. I want to help you, and there is much yet for you to do. If you believed me a numerologist, you would not follow through. I thought if I told you the truth, you would let me help you.
Zebatinsky said, "If you can see the future..."
"Why am I not the richest man on earth? Is that it? But I am rich in all I want. You want recognition, and I want to be left alone. I do my work. No one bothers me. That makes me a billionaire. I need a little real money, and this I get from people such as yourself. Helping people is nice, and perhaps, a psychiatrist would say, it gives me a feeling of power and feeds my ego. Now, do you want me to help you?"
"How much did you say?"
$50. I will need a great deal of biographical information from you, but I have prepared a form to guide you. It's a little long, I'm afraid. Still, if you can get it in the mail by the end of the week, I will have an answer for you by the..." He put out his lower lip and frowned in mental calculation. "The 20th of next month."
"5 weeks? So long?"
"I have other work, my friend, and other clients. If I were a fake, I could do it much more quickly."
"Is it agreed, then?"
Zebatinsky rose.
"Well, agreed. This is all confidential now."
"Perfectly. You will have all your information back when I tell you what change to make, and you have my word that I will never make any further use of any of it."
The nuclear physicist stopped at the door. "Aren't you afraid I might tell someone you're not a numerologist?" The numerologist shook his head.
"Who would believe you, my friend? Even supposing you were willing to admit to anyone that you've been here."
On the 20th, Marshal Zebatinsky was at the paint-peeling door, glancing sideways at the shop front, with the little card up against the glass reading numerology, dimmed and scarcely legible through the dust. He peered in, almost hoping that someone else would be there already so that he might have an excuse to tear up the wavering intention in his mind and go home. He had tried wiping the thing out of his mind several times. He could never stick at filling out the necessary data for long. It was embarrassing to work at it. He felt incredibly silly filling out the names of his friends, the cost of his house, whether his wife had had any miscarriages, if so, when. He abandoned it. But he couldn't stick at stopping altogether, either. He returned to it each evening. It was the thought of the computer that did it, perhaps. The thought of the infernal gall of the little man pretending he had a computer. The temptation to call the bluff, see what would happen, proved irresistible after all. He finally sent off the completed data by ordinary mail, putting on 9 cents worth of stamps without weighing the letter. If it comes back, he thought, I'll call it off. It didn't come back. He looked into the shop now, and it was empty. Zebatinsky had no choice but to enter. A bell tinkled. The old numerologist emerged from a curtained door.
Yes? Ah, Dr. Zebatinsky.
You remember me? Zebatinsky tried to smile.
Oh, yes.
What's the verdict? The numerologist moved one gnarled hand over the other.
Before that, sir, there's a little...
A little matter of the fee?
I have already done the work, sir. I have earned the money.
Zebatinsky raised no objection. He was prepared to pay. If he had come this far, it would be silly to turn back just because of the money. He counted out 5 $10 bills and shoved them across the counter. Well? The numerologist counted the bills again slowly, then pushed them into a cash drawer in his desk. He said,
Your case was very interesting. I would advise you to change your name to Sebatinsky.
Seba, how do you spell that?
S-E-B-A-T-I-N-S-K-Y.
Zebatinsky stared indignantly. You mean change the initial? Change the Z to an S? That's all?
It's enough. As long as the change is adequate, a small change is safer than a big one.
But how could the change affect anything?
How could any name? Asked the numerologist softly. I can't say. It may somehow, and that's all I can say. Remember, I don't guarantee results. Of course, if you do not wish to make the change, leave things as they are. But in that case, I cannot refund the fee.
Zebatinsky said, What do I do? Just tell everyone to spell my name with an S?
If you want my advice, consult a lawyer. Change your name legally. He can advise you on little things.
How long will it all take? I mean, for things to improve for me.
How can I tell? Maybe never. Maybe tomorrow.
But you saw the future. You claim you see it.
Not as in a crystal ball. No, no, Dr. Zebatinsky. All I get out of my computer is a set of coded figures. I can recite probabilities to you, but I saw no pictures.
Zebatinsky turned and walked rapidly out of the place. $50 to change a letter. $50 for Zebatinsky. Lord, what a name. Worse than Zebatinsky. It took another month before he could make up his mind to see a lawyer, and then he finally went. He told himself he could always change the name back. Give it a chance, he told himself. Hell, there was no law against it. Henry Brand looked through the folder page by page with the practiced eye of one who had been in security for 14 years. He didn't have to read every word. Anything peculiar would have leaped off the paper and punched him in the eye. He said, The man looks clean to me. Henry Brand looked clean, too, with a soft, rounded paunch and a pink and freshly scrubbed complexion. It was as though continuous contact with all sorts of human failings, from possible ignorance to possible treason, had compelled him into frequent washings. Lieutenant Albert Quincy, who had brought him the folder, was young and filled with the responsibility of being security officer at the Hanford station.
But why Zebatinsky? He demanded.
Why not?
Because it doesn't make sense. Zebatinsky is a foreign name, and I'd change it myself if I had it, but I'd change it to something Anglo-Saxon. If Zebatinsky had done that, it would make sense, and I wouldn't give it a second thought. But why change a Z to an S? I think we must find out what his reasons were.
Has anyone asked him directly?
Certainly. In ordinary conversation, of course. I was careful to arrange that. He won't say anything more than that he's tired of being last in the alphabet.
That could be, couldn't it, Lieutenant?
It could, but why not change his name to Sands or Smith?
if he wants an S. Or if he's that tired of Z, why not go the whole way and change it to an A? Why not a name like, Aaron's?
Not Anglo-Saxon enough, muttered Brand. Then, but there's nothing to pin against the man. No matter how queer a name change may be, that alone can't be used against anyone.
Lieutenant Quincy looked markedly unhappy. Brand said, Tell me, Lieutenant, there must be something specific that bothers you. Something in your mind. Some theory. Some gimmick. What is it?
The lieutenant frowned. His light eyebrows drew together and his lips tightened.
Well, damn it, sir, the man's a Russian.
Brand said, He's not that. He's a third-generation American.
I mean, his name's Russian.
Brand's face lost some of its deceptive softness.
No, Lieutenant, wrong again. Polish.
The lieutenant pushed his hands out impatiently, palms up.
Same thing.
Brand, whose mother's maiden name had been Wischewski, snapped, Don't tell that to a Pole, Lieutenant.
Then, more thoughtfully, Or to a Russian either, I suppose.
What I'm trying to say, sir, said the lieutenant, reddening, is that the Poles and Russians are both on the other side of the curtain.
We all know that.
And Zebatinsky, or Sebatinsky, whatever you want to call him, may have relatives there.
He's third generation. He might have second cousins there, I suppose. So what?
Nothing in itself. Lots of people may have distant relatives there. But Zebatinsky changed his name.
Go on.
Maybe he's trying to distract attention. Maybe a second cousin over there is getting too famous, and our Zebatinsky is afraid that the relationship may spoil his own chances of advancement.
Changing his name won't do any good. He'd still be a second cousin.
Sure, but he wouldn't feel as though he were shoving the relationship in our face.
Have you ever heard of any Zebatinsky on the other side?
No, sir.
Then he can't be too famous. How would our Zebatinsky know about him?
He might keep in touch with his own relatives. That would be suspicious under the circumstances, he being a nuclear physicist.
Methodically, Brand went through the folder again. This is awfully thin, Lieutenant. It's thin enough to be completely invisible.
Can you offer any other explanation, sir, of why he ought to change his name in just this way?
No, I can't. I admit that.
Then I think, sir, we ought to investigate. We ought to look for any men named Zebatinsky on the other side and see if we can draw a connection.
The lieutenant's voice rose a trifle as a new thought occurred to him.
He might be changing his name to withdraw attention from them. I mean, to protect them.
He's doing just the opposite, I think.
He doesn't realize that, maybe, but protecting them could be his motive.
Brand sighed. All right, we'll tackle the Zebatinsky angle. But if nothing turns up, Lieutenant, we drop the matter. Leave the folder with me.
When the information finally reached Brand, he had all but forgotten the lieutenant and his theories. His first thought on receiving data that included a list of 17 biographies of 17 Russian and Polish citizens, all named Zebatinsky, was, What the devil is this? Then he remembered, swore mildly, and began reading. It started on the American side. Marshall Zebatinsky, fingerprints, had been born in Buffalo, New York. Date, hospital, statistics. His father had been born in Buffalo as well, his mother in Oswego, New York.
His paternal grandparents had both been born in Białystok, Poland. Date of entry into the United States, dates of citizenship, photographs. The 17 Russian and Polish citizens named Zebatinsky were all descendants of people who, some half-century earlier, had lived in or near Białystok.
Presumably, they could be relatives, but this was not explicitly stated in any particular case. Vital statistics in East Europe during the aftermath of World War I were kept poorly, if at all. Brand passed through the individual life histories of the current Zebatinsky men and women. Amazing how thoroughly intelligence did its work. Probably the Russians was as thorough.
He stopped at one, and his smooth forehead sprouted lines as his eyebrows shot upward. He put that one to one side and went on.
Eventually, he stacked everything but that one and returned it to its envelope. Staring at that one, he tapped a neatly kept fingernail on the desk.
With a certain reluctance, he went to call on Dr. Paul Christo of the Atomic Energy Commission. Dr. Christo listened to the matter with a stony expression. He lifted a little finger occasionally to dab at his bulbous nose and remove a non-existent speck. His hair was iron gray, thinning and cut short. He might as well have been bald. He said, "No, I never heard of any Russian Zebatinsky, but then I never heard of the American one either." "Well..." Brand scratched at his hairline over one temple and said slowly, "I don't think there's anything to this, but I don't like to drop it too soon. I have a young lieutenant on my tail, and you know what they can be like. I don't want to do anything that will drive him to a congressional committee. Besides, the fact is that one of the Russian Zebatinsky fellows, Mikhail Andreevich Zebatinsky, is a nuclear physicist. Are you sure you never heard of him?"
"Mikhail Andreevich Zebatinsky? No. No, I never did. Not that that proves anything."
"I could say it was coincidence, but you know that would be piling it a trifle high. One Zebatinsky here and one Zebatinsky there, both nuclear physicists, and the one here suddenly changes his name to Zebatinsky and goes around anxious about it, too. He won't allow misspelling. He says emphatically, 'Spell my name with an S.' It all just fits well enough to make my spy-conscious lieutenant begin to look a little too good. And another peculiar thing is that the Russian Zebatinsky dropped out of sight just about a year ago." Dr. Christo said stolidly,
"Executed."
"He might have been. Ordinarily, I would even assume so, though the Russians are not more foolish than we are and don't kill any nuclear physicist they can avoid killing. The thing is, there's another reason why a nuclear physicist, of all people, might suddenly disappear. I don't have to tell you."
"Crash research, top secret. I take it that's what you mean. Do you believe that's it?"
"Put it together with everything else, add in the lieutenant's intuition, and I just begin to wonder."
"Give me that biography."
Dr. Christo reached for the sheet of paper and read it over twice. He shook his head. Then he said,
"I'll check this in Nuclear Abstracts."
Nuclear Abstracts lined one wall of Dr. Christo's study in neat little boxes, each filled with its square of microfilm. The AEC man used his projector on the indices while Brand watched with what patience he could muster. Dr. Christo muttered,
"A Mikhail Zebatinsky authored or co-authored half a dozen papers in the Soviet journals in the last half dozen years. We'll get out the abstracts and maybe we can make something out of it. I doubt it."
A selector flipped out the appropriate squares. Dr. Christo lined them up, ran them through the projector, and by degrees an expression of odd intentness crossed his face. He said,
"That's odd."
Brand said, "What's odd?" Dr. Christo sat back.
"I'd rather not say just yet.
Can you get me a list of other nuclear physicists who have dropped out of sight in the Soviet Union in the last year?"
"You mean you see something?"
"Not really. Not if I were just looking at any one of these papers. It's just that looking at all of them and knowing that this man may be on a crash research program and... on top of that, having you putting suspicions in my head..."
He shrugged.
"It's nothing."
Brand said earnestly, "I wish you'd say what's on your mind. We may as well be foolish about this together."
"If you feel that way. It's just possible this man may have been inching toward gamma ray reflection."
"And the significance?"
"If a reflecting shield against gamma rays could be devised, individual shelters could be built to protect against fallout. It's fallout that's the real danger, you know. A hydrogen bomb might destroy a city, but the fallout could slow kill the population over a strip thousands of miles long and hundreds wide."
Brand said quickly, "Are we doing any work on this?"
"No."
"And if they get it and we don't, they can destroy the United States in toto at the cost of, say, 10 cities after they have their shelter program completed."
"That's far in the future." "And what are we getting in a hurrah about?
All this is built on one man changing one letter in his name.
All right, I'm insane, said Brand, but I don't leave the matter at this point. Not at this point. I'll get you your list of disappearing nuclear physicists if I have to go to Moscow to get it. He got the list. They went through all the research papers authored by any of them. They called a full meeting of the commission, then of the nuclear brains of the nation. Dr. Christo walked out of an all-night session, finally, part of which the president himself had attended. Brand met him. Both looked haggard and in need of sleep. Brand said, Well? Christo nodded.
Most agree. Some are doubtful even yet, but most agree.
How about you? Are you sure?
I'm far from sure, but let me put it this way. It's easier to believe that the Soviets are working on a gamma-ray shield than to believe that all the data we've uncovered has no interconnection.
Has it been decided that we're to go on shield research, too?
Yes.
Christo's hand went back over his short, bristly hair, making a dry, whispery sound.
We're going to give it everything we've got. Knowing the papers written by the men who disappeared, we can get right on their heels. We may even beat them to it. Of course, they'll find out we're working on it.
Let them, said Brand. Let them. It will keep them from attacking. I don't see any percentage in selling 10 of our cities just to get 10 of theirs, if we're both protected and they're too dumb to know that.
But not too soon. We don't want them finding out too soon. What about the American Zebatinsky?
Brand looked solemn and shook his head. There's nothing to connect him with any of this even yet. Hell, we've looked. I agree with you, of course. He's in a sensitive spot where he is now, and we can't afford to keep him there even if he's in the clear.
We can't kick him out just like that either, or the Russians will start wondering.
Do you have any suggestions? They were walking down the long corridor toward the distant elevator in the emptiness of 4 in the morning. Dr. Christo said,
I've looked into his work. He's a good man, better than most, and not happy in his job either. He hasn't the temperament for teamwork.
So?
But he is the type for an academic job. If we can arrange to have a large university offer him a chair in physics, I think he would take it gladly. There would be enough non-sensitive areas to keep him occupied. We would be able to keep him in close view, and it would be a natural development. The Russians might not start scratching their heads. What do you think?
Brand nodded. It's an idea. Even sounds good. I'll put it up to the chief. They stepped into the elevator, and Brand allowed himself to wonder about it all. What an ending to what had started with one letter of a name.